Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello? Hello? We're almost there. All right. Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Yeah, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh, man, I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so...
Well, I'm going to start recording about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Thursday night here, Wednesday night, excuse me, here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. We look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two few items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the Rules of Civil Procedure. Better known to some as American Jurisprudence or AMJUR, the Rules of Civil Procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at Your Remedy is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy is in the Law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you, Martin, for sharing that disclaimer with us. We appreciate you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening we're going to talk about a way that you can operate in commerce without having a tax responsibility or liability legally. That's the key, legally. No wink, wink, nod, nod. Now, if you've been following us for years, you know that we have the operation for the benefit of your religious society. We call it a corporation soul, and the corporation soul is trustee over individual trusts that insulate and isolate different property that, using the euphemism, you acquire when in actuality the trust acquires it, so that the ultimate end is that you own nothing but control everything, fully control it, as though you did own it, but you don't. So if you don't own it, you can't take it away from you in a judgment. All right, well, the other side of the coin is we're people that work. We're in commerce all the time, buying, selling, trading, whatever, bartering. And unfortunately, it's looked upon in error, I'll add quickly, by the government to be an entity that is required to be responsive to something they call the internal tax system through the Internal Revenue. And so there's things that you can do. For instance, you can correct your status, make certain that the State Department of the United States understands that you are not a U.S. citizen within the confines of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, but rather you're a Union State citizen or otherwise known in the United States Code as an American national, and you can work from there. And that's all right, but you still are dealing oddly and uncomfortably and with great difficulty with the rest of the country that is operating on a different mode. So, to that end, there is a uniquely crafted, wrought LLC that you may operate through that the world, commerce, embraces with great enthusiasm. No arguments. All you need to do is to share with them that if they want your goods and services, that they acquire them through your LLC. And to that end, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Mr. Slevin will be sharing with you how this LLC originates, how it operates, and how whether you are presently an employee for a company, that you can correct that or change that position to have that company hire your LLC, and you simply become a worker for the LLC. Very simple. If you're an entrepreneur and you're running your business and you've got to deal with your tax accountant and things like that for all you're doing, well, maybe it's time that you sell your present business to this LLC for, oh, I don't know, you could even have a write-off loss for how cheaply you gave it away to this LLC. Who knows? Might work as a tax advantage that way. All reporting everything to the IRS, what you need to report, when you need to report it. So to that end, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin, and let's get into it. We lost Mr. Slevin. He just dropped off the call. How did that happen? He'll be right back. Anyways, so the point being is that you're operating uniquely in such a way through your LLC that the entire dynamics of the American workplace, the corporations, they're all so fully accustomed to it. And here Mr. Slevin has returned. I think he probably pressed the wrong button. That's good. It
you think?
I do it all the time. I think. Intuition. I do it frequently. Anyways, Mr. Slevin, I gave kind of a 30,000-foot overview.
Right, I heard that.
I just shared that it might be great for you to share the mechanics of how this comes into origin legally, correctly, wrought, if you would, and then how it affects the IRS in the tax status and how it affects the workers that work for the LLC. Go ahead.
Well, good morning or afternoon or evening, ladies and gentlemen. So there's these things out here called the rules of statutory construction. One of these rules said that a word or phrase is when defined as a term in the legislation, only that term can be used when reading and or applying the statutes. Another of these rules says that when defining a term with a list of things, they must remain in the same family. An example would be the term quote, the term edibles includes an apple, a banana, a grape, a rock, and a chicken. Obviously, the rock is not of the same class, and therefore this definition would be invalid. So here's some of the definitions from the Internal Revenue Code, which is Title 26 of the United States Code. And this is found at 7701A. When used in this title, were not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly compatible with the intent thereof, one, person. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, a state, partnership, association, company, or corporation, end quote. And we see this word individual in the list of other things that are obviously entities, such as a state and corporation. So individual is actually a delimiter. It means one of something. But what? Would that be a spotted lizard? Maybe a corporate official or a one-eyed jack? Or could it be that the term individual used in this definition is defined in Black's Law, 6th edition, which says it, the term individual is existing as an indivisible entity. Now, that would make sense. That would leave it in the same family as the rest of the things in the definition. So, another, number two of the 7701A2, it says the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. So we have definitions. Corporation are incorporated, but limited liability companies are organized. So in this definition, an unincorporated organization would indicate a limited liability company, and that's included in the term partnership. Now we go over back several hundred pages to section 701 of chapter in, which is in chapter one, which is labeled normal taxes and surtaxes. And it says a partnership, which also includes a limited liability company, as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. So that's probably where you want to be, right? Something that's not subject to, and not subject to means not liable for, and also immune is another good word for those, as a synonym for those. Second sentence, quote, persons, remember earlier we said persons? Persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for the income tax only in their separate or individual capacities. Okay, so there is a distinct statement of liability. The partners shall, or as partners, these persons shall be liable for the income tax. But you will notice that the income tax is not the subject of the tax, the income is not the subject of the tax. The function of carrying on business is what is being taxed, measured by the income. But they call it the income tax just to deceive people. So that is probably, and if you go and you look up the phrases made liable or shall be made liable, I think you'll find that nowhere else in any of the thing that deals with income taxes do you find a liability statement that succinct. So you have to be carrying on business, and it would go back to the 1909 revenue law that was the first post 16th Amendment law. You find that, and it states something to the effect of, there is hereby imposed an excise tax, excises can only be on activities, an excise tax upon income with respect to carrying on business in the corporate capacity. And so they refined that and brought it down to 701, and that's pretty much it. So understanding that, that's the legal basis for the income tax, what it's on, and which is an activity of carrying on business in the corporate capacity, and people that are not subject to it are unincorporated organizations. So how would we get one of those? Okay. Oh, by the way, that in the big court case that came out of the 1909 revenue law, which is called Flint v. Stone Tracy, this court said that, yes, this is a good excise, constitutional excise tax upon a particular privilege, which is doing business in a corporate capacity. However, a private firm, a private individual, and a private partnership are not subject to that because they cannot take partake of the privileges of doing things in the corporate capacity. So, we want one of these, right? These limited liability companies. Now, a limited liability company was first legislated in 1977, and it was a joining of the partnership and or statutory partnership and the corporation, which has always been a statutory thing. Some government made it up or chartered it, if you will. And then they changed the verbiage to so that people reading these statutes would know which form of business, partnership, limited liability company, or corporation they were reading about. So, limited liability company, the best places to get them is in New Mexico, and I'm fixing to tell you why. So, our company contracts with a client. And we come up with a name that the client would like to have their limited liability company or LLC called. So then we go down to the Secretary of State of New Mexico's website and fill out the application, which is called the Articles of Organization. Now, on these Articles of Organization, it requires a minimum of two parties. The titles of these parties are organizer and registered agent. But in New Mexico, both of these can be other LLCs. So think about that for a minute. You can have an LLC which is owned by an LLC, which is owned by another LLC, and so on and so forth. And that's the only thing that appears on the Secretary of State's books. So we have built this bulwark, if you will, and we have sister organizations within our control that go and fill these two roles of organizer and registered agent. The organizer, if nothing else has ever filed with the LLC, is considered to be the owner in perpetuity, which is how these things are done. So, just a note, you know, we've got like Delaware and Nevada, possibly Wyoming, are often touted as places to either incorporate or organize. But these states still require people's names on the list, and that's called the nominee list. Now, these states protect the list, but in New Mexico, the list does not exist. And that which does not exist cannot be found. So once this application is filled out, Secretary of State signs off on it and presents our company with a certificate of organization for this new limited liability company. Now, we have another worker, or two or three, who have not filed a 1040, and therefore they are without the jurisdiction of the IRS. IRS can't talk to them because they've never raised their hand and submitted to being a taxpayer. So they go to these non-taxpayers, if you will, go to the IRS website and go in and fill out the form to get an employer identification number for the new company. And the EIN is a form of tax identification number, as is the Social Security number. So when they go to fill out this form, it says, one of the questions says, why is the LLC requesting an EIN? Well, there's about five different answers, but we always choose this one. It's called banking purposes. And the subtitle says, select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly, that means the exactly only thing, to satisfy banking requirements or local law. Did you hear anything about taxation in there? No, because the limited liability company is not subject to the income tax. How about that? So once the party that applied for the EIN gets the new EIN for the new company, they are known as the sole member at that point in time on the IRS paperwork. They hold a meeting of the membership and come up with a resolution commissioning a third party as a manager of the LLC. Now, manager is the only officer known to the LLC. Corporations have president, CFO, directors, and such. And partnership have limited partners and general partners, but manager is the only officer in the LLC. So, to bring the certificate of organization, the EIN paperwork, and the commission back to the office, and the manager then picks it up, totes it down to a local brick-and-mortar bank that our company has a relationship with, and gets the new company a commercial and or business checking account. Comes with a debit card with only the company's name and the term manager on it, and electronic banking and all the bells and whistles that are common in today's banking industry. Once that's accomplished, it brings it back to the office. One of our back office people programs up a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Why pay-as-you-go? Because everything we do is built to keep the client's business private and anonymity as far as the new limited liability company is concerned. So we fire up the pay-as-you-go and put in the electronic banking for the brick-and-mortar bank that we've just been to, and we also like to include Square App and Cash App. Square is a point-of-sale app, so the new company, when this is all said and done, the company can then take payments via credit card and debit card and now check, okay, using the smartphone that is supplied with our private firm. And then Cash App is a peer-to-peer transfer, our cash transfer platform, but both of these can be augmented and get the new LLC another checking account under both Square and Cash App with debit cards. So once this is all done, the new company has three separate checking accounts, three separate debit cards, and ways of taking payment from all of these. So that's a good way of doing things because unfortunately the banking industry is tasked now by the government with being very intrusive, and if they don't like a little bit about what you do business-wise, they just shut you down. And so by having three separate checking accounts with debit cards, you know, if one of them fails, then you still got two, and you can roll along until that can be replaced if it's necessary. So we put all this stuff together, move the money around, make sure everything works, and put it in a box, and then ship it out to the client. Client opens the box up. The client's name is nowhere on anything involved in the LLC, its contracts, or its organization or anything else. We do everything. And once that client opens that box up, he becomes equipped to carry on business worldwide and income tax free. Sound pretty good? So that's the base model, and we can augment it depending on what the client wants and how they want to do business. Because when they receive this first box, you know, that's a very small business. You just got, you know, one worker, and we don't use the term employee. Oh, I didn't read that one, but the over in 7701A20, the term employee is about 124 words long. And so the first 109 or so just go this, that, this, that, this, that, and it gets down to it says, and the term employee includes a full-time life insurance salesman. So for all of you out there that think you've been an employee for this long, guess what? Unless you really are a full-time life insurance salesman, you don't fit the description. So anyway, back to that. So now you've got the small business model, which comes out of the box. And these can be hooked into three or four different ways. So you could have like a dentist who has a practice. One LLC could own the practice. Then the dentist needs, and the dentist is working for the practice. And then the dentist needs equipment, like the chair and its thing. So we have another LLC that owns the equipment and rents it back to the practice. So you need the building to put all this stuff in. So a third LLC will own the building and rent it back to the practice. You got several people that work with the dentist, like the receptionist and the hygienist and so forth, and they work under the umbrella of the other, like a fourth LLC. They work for it. They are workers and or performers. They are not employees because they're not full-time life insurance salesmen. So that makes that dentist and his practice judgment-proof, because if he were to be sued, he personally carries malpractice insurance, and the practice doesn't own anything other than possibly the money in the bank account, which could be quickly drained. But they can't get the equipment, they can't get the building, and they can't get the people, because those are all in separate, titled under separate LLCs. So that's a one quick and dirty complex way of doing this kind of thing. Another one, a great attribute of our limited liability companies and or private firms, if you will, is estate planning. So normally you have an estate, we'll say a car, a house, and a boat, and some cash laying around. Okay. So the owners of that, where they become incapacitated at whatever level, then all of those items or assets are called the estate. And that estate is normally carried to the beneficiaries via a will, which typically has to be probated. And there's estate taxes on stuff like this. So all this detracts from what the beneficiaries get. So in using a private firm, these beneficiaries, usually children, but not necessarily, would be issued a commission as a manager by resolution of the limited liability company. And then they would be given instructions on how to carry on the business if the principals and or mom and pop were to pass away or become incapacitated. And so on that event, instead of going through the will and the probate and all this other stuff, the kids just pull out of the safe their letters of authority, which are also called the commission as manager, which is also called the letter of authority, and the instructions, and go continue on handling the business of whatever's necessary to maintain and or dispose of those assets of the house, the car, and the boat. No estate taxes and no probate. It's all seamless. Saves a lot of money. So as Michael said, W-2 situations are on a lot of people's minds. W-2s are the form that the employer gives the employee at the end of the tax year and sends another copy to the IRS, so that the IRS now knows what the employee received as income, which all of that is bogus because they don't really fit the definitions, as we've said. So this is a contract between the employer and the employee. And there's this thing out there called the burden rate. So the burden rate, not to go in along with the dissertation, is worth about 1.5 to 1.6 the salary of the employee, as that's the bottom line cost to the employer for their services. So we're going to use this example that Joe's working for IBM. He's an employee of IBM, and he understands how this limited liability company works, and he acquires one, and he goes to the boss, and he goes, "Hey, boss, how would you like to save 25% labor cost on me, get the same person doing the same job in the same great fashion, all the same, just a lot less paperwork and a whole lot less money?" That's going to get the boss's attention, because there is not a business owner out there or business manager out there that wouldn't like to cut his labor cost by 25%. So we're going to say that Joe was making $100,000 a year. Well, that's what IBM is paying him, but it's costing him $160,000, bottom line, tax, tag, and title included. So Joe comes up and goes, "Hey, boss, instead of paying me $4,762 every 2 weeks, I'd like you to renegotiate our contract. We're going to put this new LLC in the way. And so it'll be IBM contracting with the LLC for my services. And so instead of paying as you've been paying and doing all that paperwork, you're simply going to cut the check to the LLC for $10,000 every month." So that's $120,000 over a year, which $120,000 is roughly 75% of $160,000, saving IBM 25% on its labor costs. And it's really that simple. Now, of course, all business is contract, and all contract is negotiation. So you have to make sure that, you know, do. And our company does assist in doing that, because we have done this several times. So that's a quick and easy way of explaining how the limited liability company, our product private firm, can be situated between what is now an employer and employee situation to a one company to another for services. And you really see all this all the time, except they don't do the tax savings. But when you talk about these temporary agencies, so if a company needs, you know, four guys to sweep out and clean up a garage, then he calls up the temp agency. The people actually are employed by the temp agency, but they subcontract to the guy who needs cleaning, and that's how that works. And then we just take advantage of this. And so in our example, Joe's revenue, use the right words, Chet. Joe's revenue went up from $100,000 a year to $120,000 a year. And so that's a good increase. And oh, by the way, the company now only has to fill out one piece of paper, and that is a W-9. And the W-9 goes to the limited liability company, and the other one goes to the IRS. And the IRS literally takes it, looks at it, and goes, checks the EIN, and goes, oh, that's nice, and throws it in the trash can because they have no place to settle it with, because the limited liability company is not subject to the income tax imposed. What are your questions?
Let's start with pressing *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. We have no newbies here tonight, so everyone knows that routine. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, just simply see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side to the center right of your monitor, and just type in your comment or question inside that rectangle laying on its side. Underneath it, you'll find a place to put your name and some other information if you care to. Then hit submit, and I will be more than happy to give voice to your comment or question. While we're waiting for this to populate, Mr. Slavin, I have a few questions.
Go ahead.
So let's say I've got this LLC. I acquired it through you. Let's call it Americans Restoring America, LLC. And at this point, it's just for my purposes of being hired to do – no, we'll call it Most Affordable Marketing, because I have a website under that name, mostaffordablemarketing.com. So let's say that I have this LLC, Most Affordable Marketing LLC, and it's out there, you know, offering its services. So I understand that I can be paid through this, and that I'm producing the work and so forth, just as if it's my alter ego. But now I've got a building that I want to buy and operate out of, because my wife is screaming at me for having loud conversations out of my office, and it's driving. She can't concentrate when she's trying to bake her cookies or whatever. And by the way, she makes the most awesome cookies, I'm telling you. Point being, though, is that I've got to go out now and buy a building. Do I go to you now for another LLC for that building? Because I certainly don't want one to be tagged with the other. I want to insulate and isolate. And then when I get this building, I want to put furniture in there maybe have a vehicle that I use for that purpose. Maybe I need three or four workers. Is each one of these a separate LLC that I come to you for? Can I use other LLCs? How does that work?
Literally, the sky's the limit. So I'd like to start out by saying that when speaking of these kinds of situation, using pronouns like mine and I and that kind of thing is is detrimental. Man. And I realize that, yeah, I harp on this, but in our business terminology is paramount.
Yeah.
So in your situation, the company Affordable Marketing decides it wants to expand. Now, it would do a risk to reward matrix to see whether it would be more advantageous to purchase the building under its umbrella. Okay. You, Michael, are not involved in this, but you're the functionary of the company. but you're wearing that company hat, so you're always working for the company. Now, that company pays you, and then you take that pay, and you do with it what you will. Okay? So the risk-to-reward matrix goes out and says, okay, well, this building's $100,000, and so if Affordable Marketing LLC was sued and they got a judgment on it, that would be one of the assets that could be seized. So, you know, $100,000, if in your in the company's risk to reward matrix, you go, that's more risk than I want to take. Okay, so then we want to go back and we want to put this under another limited liability company. And you could give us a call.
Is that another $7,500?
No. Okay, because we not typically, because you know, we don't want to gouge anybody. The $7,500 is the base model, and then these extraneous things like other LLCs or other accounts like crypto trading or equity trading or whatever. You know, we price those out according to the size that is necessary and the amount of time and money that our company has to spend to acquire this for the client. So we just work it out. So, you know, generally a secondary LLC would run somewhere around $1,500, something like that. But it could be more or less depending on the situation. I mean, if you're going to go buy 10 of them, obviously, you know, you get a discount of a bulk discount. So that, does that answer your question, or do we need to go into more further detail?
So I would have, let's just say I'd have Worker Bee LLC. That would be the name of the company, Worker Bee LLC,
okay.
Worker Bees.
That's
so
right.
The people that would have otherwise been known throughout the world as employees of this LLC, they're not. They're not Most Affordable Marketing anyways. They're
right.
They're workers under Worker Bee LLC.
Right, right.
Okay.
And that is a separate and distinct thing from Affordable Marketing.
Mm-hmm. And each one of the workers would bear the burden of reporting whatever taxes that they believe that they are liable for or not. And the Worker Bee LLC is in the same pattern as Most Affordable Marketing LLC in that it's not required to report anything to the IRS. Or
right.
It just operates through a 1099.
Right.
Is that
correct? And because, yes, because, okay, so you've got three or four people producing for Worker Bee, all right?
Uh-huh.
And they are being paid for that service of the production, whatever that may be,
uh-huh.
All right? Because Worker Bee, as Affordable Marketing, is not subject to income tax, that means it doesn't have to talk to anybody. It doesn't have to keep receipts or tell anybody its business. So there is no thing, such
so
a
would,
thing as
would,
a 1099. Go ahead. Hello?
So would Most Affordable Marketing not then generate a 1099 to give to Worker Bee then, LLC?
No, why would it? It's not subject to the income tax. It's not subject to the income tax. A 1099 is part of the income tax scheme. It's called third-party reporting. In this scheme of the Internal Revenue Code, you have the IRS classifies itself as the first person or first party. It classifies the taxpayer as the second party, and then anybody handing money to the taxpayer is the third party. And the third party reporting consists of things like 1099s, W-2s, 1098s, and so forth. However, if the third party is not subject to the income tax, it don't have to report nothing to nobody.
Sure.
So
because
1099,
it was,
yeah.
All these people were informed, hey, you need to become a American national. You need to correct your status.
Exactly. Yes, that's very succinct, yes.
Okay. Wonderful. All right. Any questions? I apologize for hogging up all the initial time, but that is something that I wanted to learn about. Anybody else have any questions? Press star 2 on your keypad while you're thinking about that. I'm going to go over here to Freedoms Radio and see if we can refresh there to see if anybody's posted a question there. No. We're going to have an early call tonight if nobody comes up with any questions on their own. Yeah, I knew I could always count on you, Kent. Go ahead.
Okay, good evening, gentlemen. So let me ask you a question.
He's on all the calls that we do all during the week.
Yeah, I know.
He asks the best. He asks the best questions.
Well, I do miss some of them once in a while. In any case, you were speaking about the convincing, if you will, the employer to reduce his burden rate and save X amount of dollars, 30-some percent or whatever. And you said sometimes in the past on a couple of calls you've said that, well, sometimes you have to negotiate with these people. Now, assuming that for whatever reason, one would say, I think, ordinarily, well, who wouldn't want to reduce their burden rate? Why wouldn't they do that? But let's just say, for example, that you get somebody for whatever reason that doesn't want to go along with that. What are a couple of other angles that you would use to convince them of that fact?
Well, saving 25% and 95% of paperwork, saving 25% on labor costs and 95% of the paperwork, if those two things don't do it, I doubt that there's anything else that would, because that's what business is all about.
Right. I asked the question, not to put you on the spot or ask a silly question. I was just thinking about, have you come upon, in the various, in the various things that you've handled or cases that you've handled, have you come upon any other substantive reasons that sometimes would float the boat if for some reason labor cost or paperwork doesn't do the job?
No, because anything else is simply opinion or intimidation. These, mm-hmm. these people feel intimidated by the IRS and the quote unquote government. And so, I literally had one gentleman who was was negotiating with this, with one of our clients. And he said, well, that just doesn't pass the smell test. Okay. What does that mean? Nothing other than he's got an opinion and he thinks he's right. And this new way, even though it would save him him and his business a tremendous amount of money and time and effort, in lack of paperwork, it just, just ain't right. So, and you can't fight against that because there is no logical reason to, or logical way to defeat it ain't right.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to move on.
Okay. So it's primarily the reasons are labor cost and paperwork, then, in short.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can tell you, I had a manufacturing, wholesale, retail jewelry concern for almost 30 years total. And I had three prime people in the shop and one prime person on the floor. Back in the 1990s, they were each bringing in $600 a week, which, doesn't sound like a lot of money today, but 30 years ago, 25 years ago, that was a decent wage. And I had polishers and other people like that made a lot less money as they were in apprenticeships to what they were learning as they could learn from the bench jewelers and the watchmaker and so forth. Point being, though, is as the owner of the manufacturing business, I would have saved a ton of money had I purchased these LLCs for each of these paramount people. And, it cost me that up front, but I made it back the first year.
Easily.
So, golly, I wish I'd known about this way back when. You were probably off in Desert Storm at that time, weren't you?
Neither confirm nor deny anything like that.
Yes, Kent, we can hear you. I was just sharing.
Yeah. I wanted to ask another question. I asked this question to Bernie the other night, and he said that he really wasn't familiar with this. I wanted to know whether or not, while I'm sitting here thinking about this, whether or not these types of organizations that I'll mention in a moment could play in or could fit together with these LLCs. I read an article recently about decentralized autonomous organizations, which apparently are being used by preppers to set up communities. And I think Wyoming, the article said, now I haven't researched this thoroughly, so I'm just taking what I read at face value. It said that Wyoming was the first state to recognize these autonomous organizations, and they were allowing them to file as private companies. Have you heard anything about this? And, you know, perhaps if you have or you have an idea what it's about, can you see how that might play into what you're doing?
No, because the term, the what you said, autonomous organizations. Well, that's anything. The limited liability company is a statutory organization. Okay, its parameters are defined by the statutes of New Mexico in this case. Mm-hmm. So there are statutory partnerships. All right, partnerships have existed forever. You know, one or two people got together and worked in combination under one name, and that was known as a partnership because it was typically small. All right. Then mm-hmm. the government got into it and started doing statutory corporations and giving them tax breaks, for lack of a better way of saying it. So that's how these came about. Now, the limited liability company is a great interface because everybody in the business world knows how to do it. Okay. So that's the foundation. These autonomous organizations are just that, but any organization, any group of people can get together and organize and work together for a common goal, you know, whether it be, you know, providing food or storable food for a cataclysmic event or whatever. So, you know, so the difficulty with autonomous organizations is if you go and try to interface with the statutory business world, they just go, well, no, we can't deal with you because you're just, you know, you're not quote unquote recognized by us. Okay. So from what I understand from the article you read, that the state of Wyoming is allowing this recognition to take place, and then the autonomous organizations can interface with the statutory business world. All right. Mm-hmm. And so that's fine. But, you know, our organization, particularly when dealing with trust, because if a trustee walks into a bank and says, hey, I want to get a business account for this trust, they look at you sideways, or they have these preconceived notions that trust are bad or whatever, and it gets to be hard. But our organization, our LLCs, are a great interface because everybody in the business world knows how that an LLC functions and what it does and how it does it. And so when you say, hey, I need a business account from this LLC, no problem, here, sign here, sign here, sign here, done. Mm-hmm. And that's,
well, they've been around,
really that simple. Huh?
Well, they've been around about 45 years now, I think, right? Wasn't it the late 70s?
1977 was the first legislation of the limited liability company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I want to say, I think that Mike makes a good point regarding the employer purchasing the LLCs for the employees, because in the past, while you mentioned that once or twice in passing, and correct me if I'm wrong, you more or less stressed the fact that, you know, you might alert your employees to this and then have them go out and make these arrangements. But it'd probably be much easier if the employer was to do this for them, and there'd probably be enough saving that it would be worth it. So I think that's
a
good point.
Absolutely. Yep. Everybody gets protected. Everybody gets a pay increase.
Mm-hmm. That's it for my questions. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Next is Norman. Go ahead, Norman.
Good evening. And hello, Mr. Spivin.
Good evening.
Okay, I have a situation coming up. I'm a retired pilot, and I'm going to partner
that,
with
that
another pilot.
That means he gets high, Mr. Spivin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Norman. Don't listen to the peanut gallery.
A simulated training company. Now, this other fellow already has a C Corp. And what I have in mind after hearing you is to create an LLC and somehow partner with his C Corp. And he's going to have 51. I'm going to have 49% of the company. So we split that appropriate. And how would that work? So I'll give it back to you to tell me.
Well, it wouldn't be your stuff. It would be the limited liability company negotiating with the owners of the C Corp for a joint venture. And so this would all be contractual. And so any place where your name would typically be put, then the limited liability company's name would be put. And there's this thing called the operations agreement, which is after the limited liability company has been organized, then the operations agreement fills out and shows the members and management of the limited liability company, who's responsible for what, and so forth and so on. Okay, that is on par with what's called the Articles of Incorporation, which also lists the same kind of things. And this is, we just went through one with these two partners. They had grown, I believe it was a Florida LLC, up to the point where they could sell it for roughly $1 million. And so the one of the partners heard about our product and got in touch with us, and we got that Florida LLC's operations agreement and researched it and found the methodology outlined in that document to substitute the member of the Florida LLC out and one of our product LLCs in. So when the company, the Florida LLC, was sold for $1 million, the $500,000, the check for it was written to our private firm LLC. And the guy that was now behind the scenes didn't take any tax hit because the private firm, the New Mexico LLC, is not subject to the income tax. So that's the methodology. Just you have to research and things like the operating agreement and so forth and so on. This is all part of the negotiations. And so that also shows that we have some experience in working with intercompany negotiations for a joint venture. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Now, and you would be the administrative part to take care of all these contracts and agreements and et cetera, et cetera. Is that correct?
Well, we would negotiate that. We have this whatever you do now is your business model, and we build a brand new one that is entirely independent of your circumstances or anybody else. It's a brand new thing, not subject to the income tax. And so once it's in your hands, which we transfer to you privately, there's no public notification that you have anything to do with this new LLC. Once it's in your hands, then those two business models will be integrated, and they can be integrated as little or as much as your situation and your preferences desires. Okay, so this integration time frame falls under what we call our hotline services, which is by subscription, and it's free for the first year. It typically runs you know, the typical use of it is 1 hour per month. But, you know, in your particular situation, we would go into the relationship between our company and you, knowing that this is what you want to do. And so we would, from the ground up, we would be able to go, okay, well, we need to have this over here situated and that over there, you know, turned around. And then we would do the negotiations depending on the contracts and the operating agreement and the articles of incorporation that are already existing with that business model. So, yeah. Now, you know, if it gets overtly complex, then, you know, there may be some extra charges. But normally the integration isn't that difficult. And then, as I said, it was a subscription. So after the first year, and the subscription is renewed for $500 for the next year. But if a person does not renew the subscription, lets it lapse, then, and you call us up and need some kind of negotiation or something done with the company, then we charge $500 an hour, first hour up front. So that's an indication that you probably want to keep that subscription in vogue. But that's basically how that falls out. But we would know, you know, in the early negotiation for getting it, if you already know what you want to do, then we build that into the business and go from there. Make sense?
Yeah. So in your opinion now, since he has a C Corp, he would file an income tax return on his C Corp and pay whatever appropriate tax there would be. Is that correct?
That, yes. Short answer. There's a longer one, but it's not really pertinent right now.
Okay. Okay, there might be a workaround.
Yeah, well, the point is you have become knowledgeable and you understand, and everything that our company does is by statute. It's how they really wrote it down, but then they changed it around and obfuscated it and all that good stuff. So you've become informed on the situation. And so this gentleman, he's just doing what his CPA and or lawyer says, oh, yeah, that's the way it's always done. That's because they're paid to make sure that that happens. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, so another point is I'm not a young guy anymore, so whenever I leave this world and go to the big crystal cathedral in the sky, the LLC will pass to my heirs by contract. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and do you provide any management in that case of the LLC
I'm
gone?
Yeah, we can.
We have
templates already set up that, you know, you just punch in this and punch in the name and the address and so forth and so on, and they're generic. I mean, in that article, and, you know, so. But if they become more complex, depending on the size of the enterprise that you build up, you know, and something other than that may be done. I mean, I was in the negotiation I was doing with that Florida LLC. I found out afterwards that the LLC, Florida LLC, had paid a law firm something in the neighborhood of $20,000 to make this operations agreement between just two guys.
Wow.
So yeah, but that's the going rate for, you know, all the little dots and tittles and everything that's what lawyers do. So
okay, now regarding the filing of the annual, I think it's 1065 or whatever it is for the LLC.
No.
Do you take care of that?
No.
Or do I find my own account?
No. What part of not subject to the income tax? If it's not subject to the tax, then the 1065, which is part of the Internal Revenue Code, does not apply. You don't.
Okay.
The LLC does not have to talk to anybody anytime. even a court judgment would be extremely hard to enforce because it's based on faulty information. It's based on the perceived fact that the LLC is subject to the income tax and therefore subject to the rules and regulations of whatever government. But it's not. And oh, by the way, New Mexico
there's nothing.
That LLC doesn't have to keep a receipt or anything.
Wow. Okay. So
yeah.
No,
wow. Exactly. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. I just got to report all this back to my partner to be and say, here's how we're going to do it. So, when it gets to that point, I'll get him in a conference and maybe we'll do a conference call. And if there's any questions, in the meantime, I'll talk to you beforehand and get all set up and so on. Okay, well, thank you very much for the preliminary info. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
I'm out.
All right. All right. Thank you so much, Norm. We appreciate that. And anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to wrap it up tonight. And let's check Freedoms Radio real quick. Ba-ba-ba-ba-bum. Refresh. Nobody there. All right. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Slevin, any parting words for tonight?
Have a great day.
Good evening, sir. Thank you, too. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this evening. Till next week, good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.